I would now like to introduce our guest speaker for the month, James L. from Dover, and he'll be speaking on steps 10, 11, 12.
Good evening, everybody. I'm a grateful drunkard. My name is James.
Hey, James.
I'd like to give a hundred glory to God for allowing me another day clean and sober. It's always good to be at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially for anything like I am. And as I usually like to say, I'm a hopeless drunk. Outside God's divine help. So don't get excited. I may appear a little somber to you, but I'll liven up sooner or later, I think. AA has a way of doing that to me. I believe up to this point, I've tried to explain that I found out that I had a bodily and mental problem, which put me in a dilemma to needing a power greater than myself to turn my will and my life over to. I recognized that I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of that old life I was living so that I can get on the archway of building a new one. I found out that I needed to get some obstacles out of the way and come to find out that I couldn't do it by myself, so I had to humbly ask God to help me to remove it. I come to realize that I had to be willing not only just to look at the stuff in my four-step list that I needed to take care of, but there were some people that I had to become willing to make right with that was around some of those people too that kind of extended my list a little bit. I had to at least become willing to do that. And then I had to make some direct amends to some of the stuff that I found out in five when I sat across the table from that man who helped me to see the other half of the truth that I didn't see. And now I'm standing at this point now where I'm starting to get some results because I was willing to do just about everything I can imagine to have victory over alcohol. And as of God's grace, even for James not to have found it necessary to drink since June 11th of 1994, that victory still belongs to one and one only whom I call my higher power, whom I call God. So that's the shield of my strength. So now I'm faced at that step 10 area of my work now. And for a long time, I used to sit in meetings, and I used to always listen to people talk about the 10th step like it was the go-to-bed step. And then I used to wonder why I used to have so much turmoil in my sleep. Now, if you think I'm kidding, maybe you could relate to this. Remember your active drinking? Remember being in a subconscious state, some of us like to call it sleep? And find yourself popping up out of your sleep in the middle of the night with sweat beading over your brow, your hands real clammy, and then you reach down under the bed for it, and you crack the top, you take a hit, and you go, whew. Well, I come to realize if I do what the book says, and I am prompt about trying to make right new mistakes as they crop up, I tend to do like it says in the commentary, to sleep of good conscience. I don't wrestle as much with myself when I'm sleeping at night. Now, we all got stuff, you know, but I'm not talking about that kind of stuff. You know, I came to AA to learn to live life, so there's going to be some days where, you know, like right now I'm in the middle of doing a roof. So on rainy nights, you know, my eyes tend to, you know what I mean, listening for drips. When I'm not talking about that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the kind of stuff that had to do with my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, and my fear. And these are the things that I must ask God to remove from me at once. So no wonder he collaborated this step for me and said, prompt. You know, I know when I did something wrong to you. And I kind of was leading up to that last week. And I wanted to take a time out to tell y'all that last week, in a moment of inspiration, I decided to come clean on some things that I normally wouldn't talk about in meetings because I have a tendency to feel real comfortable. Now, you know, I haven't done anything to anybody that the statute of limitations has not subsided. You know what I mean? I don't believe that I ever took a life of another human being. I ain't saying I didn't want to, but I didn't, you know what I mean? So I want to clear that up with you. And that was not to present myself as a gorilla killer of any kind. The truth of the matter is that like then, I could not take an inventory of myself because I dared not look. The vital sixth sense wasn't there that I kind of have now. Most of us who have done this process know what I mean by the vital sixth sense. You know, I've been telling this guy over here how much I didn't like that guy in the meeting. Now I see the guy coming across the room, and I know, I can feel inside that I'm going to behave in a manner that is going to be unacceptable. I already know it. But am I going to listen to that vital sixth sense, that still and quiet voice in my head that says, now you know how to behave. So when he comes up and shakes my hand, I want to give him one of them little jellyfish. Yeah, what's up? But and then wonder a day later or a week later when I run into him again why I feel so uncomfortable in his presence. You know, the commentary is not a big thing I like to talk about, but the commentary did give me some insight on little things that I was reading out of the big book. And the commentary told me, it said that the reason that I was falling into areas like that is I could not recognize that you too was going through growing pains. And it was just like it said in the big book back in page 66 when we were looking at our inventory, that he was right when he said, we had seen how others had wronged us, but that is about as far as we went. You know what I mean? And then I clamored for victory. You know, I looked for the way to win the battle. And just like he said, it was short-lived. You know, there I was walking away now, because now the spiritual lifestyle, the spiritual theory I am trying to live, and I can't be what I was and also live this thing that is not a theory. Because I come to realize it's not a theory. It's not just an idea in my head that this young man, this man who went through what you heard I went through, is now trying to walk a life that is trying to be at maximum benefit to my fellow man and my creator with what God has given to me up to this point. It may not be much to some, but it may be the only thing that another drunk will have in that moment with me and him, that God took this thing that was considered a waste and made it a gift to somebody else. So the spiritual life is not a theory. So here I am at step 10, and the one thing that we always love to hear is, I love this oxymoron that's thrown around in the don't drink and go to meetings, is that, how do you maintain growth? You mean to tell me you know it's growing, but you're going to maintain it? So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to do a light confession to you. As soon as you start telling me that I am able to achieve a certain spiritual place, I tell you I'm working on it. Because that's how I maintain me not having to look at this part of the inventory where I says, yes, I was selfish with this person. So I'm just gonna say, you know, I'm sorry right now, you know. When I really know that I might need to go deeper than that and ask them, what can I do to make it right? Because they were the ones that was offended, and what will it take for us to be in harmony again? You know, I don't want to sometimes go to that death, so I'll maintain that area, you see. I'm going to take care of it. But it tells me that when I'm having difficulty like that, that all I simply had to do was say, not my will, thy will be done. And the founders said to me that this was the proper use of the will. Meaning that once I took this ongoing attitude about an inventory, the same one that he told me way back in step 4, that he told me to use to get me to this point, now he's telling me I can use it on a day-to-day basis. I can use my inventory as my walk-around step. I can process something now a lot quicker than I could prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Before, I did not know how to stop in the middle of my day and take one sheet of paper, a piece of scrap, and a crayon, and make 4 columns and go, oops, and turn right back around. Like today, I'm a little quicker than that. I can sit in my head and say, ooh, the name, I believe that this is what caused it. I'm affected like this. Yeah, I did do that. Excuse me. Can I talk to you a minute? I don't like the fact that in one moment I wanted to strangle you, and at the next moment I'm standing there knowing I'm wrong. So I had to say, not my will, thy will be done, the same way my higher power said, if it's possible, pass this bitter cup. Because what he had to do, he didn't feel like doing. But then he recognized, he said, nevertheless, not my will, thy will be done. And today I got a higher power by which I can believe. Now, I realize that. And I'm in this place where I don't know how to go any further than that. And then it tells me now I got more action to do. So then I go to sleep with that kind of inspiration in me from this 10-step walk around step where I'm trying to watch my step and I'm trying to be somewhat on a spiritual plane contingent on the way I want to be conditioned. How well do I want to be conditioned? I mean, I don't know about you. If I got some badly soiled clothes, I don't just want you to rinse them. I think I need to be a little thorough. I might have to scrub at it a little bit and work at it. You know what I mean? And that's what got me at this point now. This is where I'm at. And like now I'm looking at step 11, and step 11 is telling me that I'm not going to always be inspired to do these things. And then he tells me that how God gave me brains and how I should use them. And then he actually told me how to wake up in the morning. He told me to get rid of these self-seeking motives and stuff like that. And to wake up with something on my mind other than me. You know? But then also, I believe that what is going on here is that I kind of have an idea of where Bill is leading me. And no wonder it's real easy for people to start thinking that 10, 11, and 12 is maintenance steps. I don't want to continue to maintain something that I know could be brighter and more beautiful as long as I'm willing to continue to do it again. So I believe in cycle of steps. I believe that what I heard many of experienced AA people who have applied these principles to their lives talk about, what I really would like to be able to one day be able to honestly confess to you is that I am now living in a place of emotional stability and spiritual maturity. That's where I want to be one day. That's my goal in AA. My goal in AA is not to be the greatest conference speaker of all time. It is not. My goal is to be able to wake up in the morning and know that my God loved me enough not to allow me to find it necessary to pick up a drink that could not only destroy me, but destroy my relationship with my woman, my kids, my friends, with you guys, my employer. And that vision that y'all said that was for me, I no longer have it. I no longer see that your suggestions are going to work for me. Because y'all not inspiring me like you used to. So I'm putting all this responsibility on other human beings when it's told to me a long time ago, way back in the beginning, that I can no longer place my dependency upon things human. And now he's telling me when there's tough thoughts and decisions that all I got to really do is hang in there and trust and listen for God's will. And if I listen close enough, God's will will always be exposed to me. And therefore, it would only do one thing and one thing only, to improve me consciously with my connection to my God. It will. I guarantee anybody who ever tried. And the first thing he tells you, he said, let's see what these religious people were right. Okay. Now I might piss off a few AA people, but let's take a look and see where they write. Here go a bunch of people that go through the same things that I used to go through. They used to have homes in the middle of foreclosure. They used to have families almost near separation. But there they were in a meeting place, asking a power greater than themselves to restore them. And they were patient. They were hardworking, and they were caring to the guy next to him who was going through his stuff, and sooner or later God's will was done, either if he liked it or not. There's your improvement right there. Because see, my whole problem was way back, like it says in step 3, I was running around trying to play God in all my circumstances and situations. So if I'm still running around trying to play God in all my circumstances and situations, am I really improving in my conscious contact to God as I understand Him? Absolutely not. So now I understand that, you know, these things that my sponsor was teaching me, and not only teaching me, but showing me to do, I no longer could tell you I didn't know how to do it. So if I look back at step 10, they told me that love and tolerance was our code. Dr. Bob, in one of them speeches that he said that everybody in this room knows what love and service is. And he said, I remember when I heard him say it, I was like, whoa, you know, yeah, I kind of do. You know what I mean? No matter where I was at that day, when he said that, I do understand what he mean, that we all know what love and service is. I clamored all my life looking for love and looking to be served. And there was times that people in my life had showed me what love was, and there was times that people had served me. So I knew what it was. but I was almost running around here as if I was incapable of ever giving it. And there's something wrong with that. I remember hearing somebody one time say, you know, how can you ask for something that you're unwilling to give? You know what I mean? And I didn't understand what they meant by that kind of principle back then. And it was always these kind of, like Dr. Silkworth said, those kind of moral psychologies that always seemed far from me. So no wonder prayer was necessary for me. No wonder I needed a petition. I needed to sit before God and say, God, why am I constantly walking around here thinking that just because my fiance said to me no, that I need to go out here and take a drink so I can tell her why? You know what I mean? Why is it that the boss told me things are slow right now and I need to lay you off, that now I want to burn down the factory? You see? And I could not present these things to God and say, God, help me to see what I need to see here. The man simply said he did all he could do for me up to this point. And most bosses who I ever had laid me off had said this to me. They said, James, I'm sorry to have to announce to you that things are slow here at the factory right now. We're going to have to lay off a few people. And the first thought in my mind was, me? And then I wanted to turn and point my finger at people who I thought deserved to be laid off other than me, not realizing that up to this point that God had provided for me what he had provided for me up to that point, and that now that inspiration that I came into work with every day now seems to be gone. It seems to have been gone. So again, here it is in the big book that I'm learning these things, and now I'm at the point where I'm thinking, oh man, how do you meditate? I ain't know much about meditation. I remember walking past churches where I used to see preachers sitting in them chairs that they sit in, and you walk by like at 11 o'clock in the morning, and then you come back by there around 1 o'clock, and he's still sitting there. Didn't seem like he moved much. Didn't look like the expression on his face changed much. Didn't look like, you know, I didn't see anything glowing around him or any fireworks or anything. But I seen a man that had a look upon his face as if he was hearing something. And I kind of have those moments now. And I'll kind of share one with you to let you know where I'm coming from. About 2 years ago, I've been at my job that I'm at now for about a year. And I had never had a job that compensated me for my labor like this one, or gave me the opportunity to express, you know, my ability for whatever it was worth. And I'm now having some changes happening to me. I'm now starting to be able to buy other people a sandwich and a cup of coffee. I am now able to kind of like, you know, slide a brother a 20 when he need one, you know. And I'm realizing that I was on the other end of that not too long ago. And I'm driving to work. It's early in the morning. I mean, it's early. Like 6:30 in the morning. And I would like to say that my charismaticism and all of that stuff, listening to the gospels that I like to listen to, played a part in that. But that wasn't it, because I had for the first time really experienced what it's like to tap into the unlimited load. And at that moment, whatever God would have asked for me, I was willing to give. And I said, I would like to be able to feel like that every day. And as I'm driving the car, I'm listening to my heart. And all of a sudden, I had to pull over on the side of the road, and tears of joy just ran down my face. For the first time in my life, I have felt value without a woman giving herself to me, or some Cadillac, or some, you know, prestige, or some honor I was given, or something like that. Just for the sheer moment of knowing that God was with me, I had to pull over because I was unable to drive, and all I could do was fold my hands in my lap and cry. Now, it's kind of hard to tell you guys this, especially being 6 foot two, 235 pounds, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of hard to express moments like that. You know what I mean? And to have that kind of stuff. And the funny part that amazed me the most is that I wasn't in one of those places where that normally happens to me. you know, one of them places where the choir's rocking in the background, you know what I mean? And the man's preaching, you know, and the emotions are kicking in, and I get that moment of inspiration and the joys of my higher power kicking in. My arms go wide open, and I'm crying because I feel the convictions of the world laying down on me. Nah, I ain't talking about that. I'm talking about the kind of inspiration that told me that my sobriety was all worth it, regardless of how you valued it. But at that moment, everything that was given to me meant something. And nothing at that moment felt like that. Now, I've had many of, I guess we can call them spiritual experiences and this, that, and the other. But it was those kind of moments that led me into chapter 7. Because without that kind of driven joy from inside, it is hard to go up to a man who smells like bourbon, puke all over him, saying, "Get in my car." I'm going to pause on that one a minute. I don't think y'all heard me. It is hard, outside of having that kind of contact with God, to have a man who's smelling like bourbon, puke all over him, and urine in his britches, and you put him in your car. I can do that today. Any other time, I said, "Look." And I don't know where that comes from, but I know that because I was able to do that, just like it says in that paragraph, I did not miss the miracle. You don't miss it. Even if that guy asked you to be his sponsor or not, you won't miss that miracle happening right before your eyes. I was the guy that old timers used to look at and say, "Come to me when you get serious." Because I would come in here for a short period of time and go back out. Just keep coming in and going back out. Until finally a man stepped into my life that understood that 7th chapter. And he didn't poke around and prod in my life. He simply stayed as helpful to me as he possibly could. You know, now some people who don't like big book thumpers said, "Oh, you know, like the book said, you know, don't present this book to him right away." Well, the point is, if you read a little further, it tells you, talk to him the same way that you read about in the chapter about alcoholism. So therefore, indirectly, I'm going to talk about the book. Because like I heard someone else says, I did not come in here with this knowledge. So y'all had to first carry a message to me, and then that message is what gave me that experience that morning when I finally tapped into God through meditation, because I used to always try to practice meditation. You know, I always knew how to do devotion, being a man of Judeo-Christian practices and theology and stuff like that. I always knew how to have devotion that would lead me into a meditative thought of the theories and the ideas and the concepts by which this word of God is trying to inspire us, and I would meditate upon that. But just to be riding down the street and be meditating about the goodness that I heard somebody mention, like me personally, I heard the old timer say it a dozen times, I didn't get what I deserve. I never in AA this past 10 years, almost 10 years, have not gotten what I deserve. Because if I had gotten what I deserve, I wouldn't be here tonight. So the mercy and the forgiveness that my God has given me, I try to seek that in myself for others. Now, I might stand up here sometimes and talk about things I see and dislike. Like they said, I'm not judging. I'm just relaying the facts. You know what I mean? And the point of what I mean by that is that step 12 is not like it used to be. And I don't mean to step on nobody's toes, but the truth of the matter is that, you know, we like to kind of get rid of them a little quicker than we used to be able to. We no longer have to sit and nurse a guy like we used to have to nurse him. So our 12-step work is not as hard as it one day might be, because these rehabs and detoxes ain't taking them in as frequent as they used to. And if you was anything like I was, they had told me on the phone, it was like, been here and done that. You know, and this last time around, it was real hard for me to find a place that would take me in. So I needed people that was willing to carry this message. Believe me, I was 14 years coming around this rooms before I even got to this point or was even introduced to the process as it's outlined in our book. I suffered and paid a dear price for that. And the reason that I'm telling people that, if you're new or if you're struggling, the reason I'm telling you that is because I don't wish that pain on nobody. To have to know that, you know, that you could feel the way I felt that day and know that I had put it aside for 14 years out of the sheer inability to be willing. No more. No wonder Herbert Spencer said it could leave us in a state of everlasting ignorance. It almost did in my case. I was content prior to investigation. I would sit there and say, yeah, man, that might work for Gene and them. And, you know, it might work for this person and that person and stuff, but I ain't with all that. You know, especially in the condition that I was in. So it really took somebody who had a spiritual awakening, who could see beyond my sickness and beyond my nonsense and behind my state of ignorance to just be willing to hang in there with me long enough, because they were able to take that unlimited load that they had and they were saying, listen, anytime you want it, you can have the whole thing. And I said, no, just give me that little bit right there. Hey, because somebody who was real intelligent one day told me, take what I want and leave the rest. Oops. Take what you want and leave the rest. There's some things that I hear sometimes that scare me in rooms. Stuff like this. I come to AA because booze stopped working. You think about that a minute. I'm not coming to AA because booze stopped working. I come to AA because booze worked real good. And if you think I'm lying, there's a little spot down the street where I think they serve beverages with your dinner. You walk in there, there's guaranteed. There's one joker sitting over there, a little beady-eyed. And if you ask him how you doing, he said, I'm doing real good right about now. I don't know how well he's going to be doing later. But I know that if he's anything like I am, that elixir is working for him for the moment. And I'm not here to play the boogeyman about booze. Because the book don't tell me to talk about booze in a bad way. It tells you in the last couple of paragraphs of chapter 7 that if you approach the newcomer that way, he might get a little ticked off. Now, if y'all anything like I am, and I said this before here, and I'll say it again in the parking lot. When you talk bad about alcohol, that's like talking about one of my ex-girlfriends. I might not care much about her. I might not even be with her no more. I might say a few things about her, but it ain't cool, you do it. If you're a real alcoholic. The 12th step also in chapter 7 tells you, if you are now convinced that he is a real alcoholic, and now it tells you how to present yourself. But up to that point, it is not up to me to pronounce that anyone be called an alcoholic. Because I know for a fact, for myself, there's some people in here that ain't real alcoholics. Maybe not here, because if y'all listen to me, y'all sure stumbled and puked. I'm telling you that. And if you didn't stumble and puke, you probably sit there going, I don't really particularly care for this guy. And the reason that I'm saying that is I learned way back in my step one reading, and there's a solution, that there was people who stumbled and found their way in here who could take it or leave it. They could take it or leave it. They may not tell us that in the discussion meeting, but they'll show it to us about 90 days into the program. Because they'll say, I'm coming back. And if you're a real alcoholic like I am, you're terrified of the idea of allowing yourself to be misguided by that idea of the first drink. And you're coming here so you can hear the truth about alcoholism. Alcoholism won't kill you. It'll beat you up real good, though. But booze will kill you dead if you're a real alcoholic. Booze, again, a certain kind of hard drinker will come in here. Y'all know who I'm talking about. He's the guy, you know, they said may physically mentally impair him, and it may even kill him a few years before his time. Or he might come in and say, man, that third DWI, that taught me a lesson. They talking about taking my license for about 10 years, man. And I'm a real alcoholic sitting there saying, hell, I don't need no license to drive. It might be funny, but that's the God and honest truth. I drove around a long time without ever even going to DMV for a license and was driving drunk without a license, was never registered to drive. Because I was too lazy to go down there and read the book, take the test, and get a license. So what I did is I sold drugs, told my aunt to go buy a car in her name, and I drove it around town. It had a nice system and everything. The cops would pull me over. They would ticket me. I had the cash. I paid the bill. Then they towed the car. And I said, I had to go get my car. Not knowing that I'm putting her in a worse of damnation than my own. And then having to make that right really sucked. Because I had to really do some things for her that I really didn't want to have to do. Because I felt that, you know, she got paid, you know. See? And now how do you help somebody like me? You know, you got to be really knowing the real code of love and tolerance. Because there's some people that was real patient with James. And you had to have had, not having one. You can't be having a spiritual awakening while you're working with James. Because you need to be able to tap into an inner resource at any God-given moment with me, drunk or sober. You know, I may be going through some stuff in my life or in my personal relations or whatever, and you trying to help James, and I'm like, oh, wait. The book even said that. It said, be careful going to man on spiritual matters, for you know not how much he knows. I had guys come up to me trying to tell me about high power JC. I said, whoops, slow it down, bro. There's some brothers in here tell you, man, last thing in the world, you think I'm bad with the big book, don't start that up. You know what I mean? Because I was one of those people that did not reject the idea of religious denominational ideologies or theology. I have no problem with that. I'm not presenting that to you either. What I'm trying to talk to you about is a message, a program of action that went along with this belief that I had, and I got a result. Because just like someone said earlier, I had a whole lot of faith and a gut full of booze. I was like the Temptations. I was that Rolling Stone, you know what I mean? I was that Joker, you know what I mean? Did some storefront preaching, you know what I mean? And drunk as a skunk the next 5 minutes. I could go to church on a Sunday morning, boy, be all fired up. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, half in the bag. That's a shame. And that was a lot of internal pain. At this point now, I went through my first cycle. And now I'm walking around AA for a while. I've had a spiritual awakening. And I feel real good that I had completed a cycle of steps and thought that I didn't need no more of an experience because I had people telling me, you only need to do the steps one time around. That's it. One time. So now what was happening was I was introduced to some other concepts of ours or some other principles like our traditions and concepts that detailed that I now take a different approach at the steps other than worrying about alcohol. The steps had to work for me in a lot of different areas. I'm not talking about those first three. I'm talking about those inventorial steps. They helped me to process a lot of different things in my life. And I'm talking about how that helped me to be able to be worked with the same way I worked with others. I had to tell guys came up to me and asked me to sponsor them who had 4 and 5 years already, and nobody never really introduced them to the process. How do you help a guy like that? You know, he's coming up to you. I had a guy have more time than me one time, but he wanted an experience with the big book. How do I help him? See, you know, as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always had my focus on the guy that came stumbling into the meeting. And one time I almost got put out of the meeting one night when I got so upset. I said, listen, we always running out here worrying about dragging new drunks in here when we got a bunch of sick ones sitting right here. And the old timer got mad with me. You don't know anything. I'm like, what? You know, I just got irritated because that's what they were doing. It was like they were so, there we was most of us were sober members in the room, and some of the dialogue that was going on in this closed discussion meeting was practical, everyday events that nobody was taking a spiritual approach to. They were actually trying to get advice on how to maneuver and manipulate people to work in a condition by which they want it. And when you sober, you kind of see it and you go, ooh. But God forbid if you that person like one of us that say, I'm a drunk named James. Sounds like fear. And then after the meeting, I wasn't talking about fear. I was just talking about the fact that I might not get the job. All right. That's where we go. Keep coming. You know? And you know that the message is needed there. But the hardest place of all that I ever had to apply these steps was in my own home. God, I hate making inventories at home. Because I got to live with it. You know, it's always easy to be prompt with you. Because I, you know, you may see me later. They see me all the time. Me and Mama, sometimes we bump heads. And sometimes I'm hesitant about saying I'm sorry. Sometimes I have to do that. Sometimes I have to be just as prompt with her as I'm willing to be with him. But I figured, hey, it's a give and take thing, you know. But the truth of the matter is, I'm just a sick puppy just trying to get better, man. And I don't want to get so big in my own mind. I got to remember what my first sponsor in California, Alton, told me. Alton said to me, he said, the day that you think that you have the only message is when you went back to sleep after being awakened. I don't never want to get there, man. So I continue to seek out people like, you know, Barefoot and Gene, and a few brothers like Mike and a few of y'all, and catch you in the parking lot, and we get excited and pumped up. And it's not that I'm unteachable or anything. I'm just excited when the dialogue starts. I was always one of those people who could chew gum and walk, you know. I wasn't one of those drunks that came in the room and said, I was so fogged my first 90 days. You know, I was never like that, man. And the people that had told me that I had sponsored, who said that they couldn't read the book or they couldn't comprehend the book, I would go by their house in the morning to pick them up for a meeting, and there they were at their kitchen table sipping coffee and reading the paper. And then you got them in the car and you're driving and you're going, did you read what I told you to read? And you know, you like clenching the steering wheel and you like, you know, you like in pain because you know that the reason that he was willing to read the paper because that had his interest. And there he was coming in the meeting talking about I need a sponsor and I need to go through the steps. But I have no willingness to read the doctor's opinion, but I had all the willingness in the world to see who got locked up last night. That's why I get amazed when people said, I had to pray to God for patience. All you got to do the steps and start sponsoring people. You get all the patience you need. Ain't that right, Bill? Hey, yo, now, y'all might not see me and Bill running together all the time, but those of us who have a bunch of pigeons, we'll tell you, boy, you get some lively ones. I mean, sober. It's Tuesday. What I do? I don't know. Live it. You know what I mean? It's like... I know it sounds humorous, but that is the degree by which the alcoholic used his brain. Almost instinctual. I can't fix it. Now, what was that problem? When you fix something that quick and you're not drinking, and you used to instant solutions, and the sponsor say, easy does it. Take a look at what you're doing first. Easy, easy, easy. Let's take a look at what's really going on. I couldn't handle that in the beginning. I don't know about y'all. I needed a perfect family. I needed a job that was going to compensate me at the rate by which I believed I deserved. How do I get to be the CEO next week? I'm tired of looking up at the glass ceiling. You know what I'm saying? Hey, you my sponsor. You're supposed to be able to get me there. These are the kind of childlike behaviors that were in me. And then when I did get to certain places where I thought I had succeeded, my grandiosity did kick in. And the sponsor would recognize it. He would call me over. He said, easy.
What are you talking about?
Look how you going.
I ain't doing nothing.
And then I would feel you guys kind of, hey, Jay, what's that about? Sponsor said, well, stop being a freight train. He said, what? So you're freight training. So what do you mean? He said, everybody you come in contact with, man, you got to be bigger than what you are. And then he told me the truth to my face. My self-esteem was still low. And I had already completed the cycle of steps. And I was still running around here feeling superior. But deep down inside, I felt less than I ever felt in a long time. I'm going to tell y'all something that you may not want to hear. There is a thing, another little, it's not a disease, but it is a side effect to sobriety, and it's called an emotional bottom. Some of us get them early, like me, and some of us get them later. But the worst pain I ever had to be 12-stepped out of was when I know how to stay sober. I know I'm not going to drink, but I can't get out of this one little particular behavior I got going on, and it's almost about to kill me. On one hand, there's the idea of a drink, and on the other hand, there's the idea of a 38 with one bullet with my name on it. And I'm coming to meetings, and I want to die. But I'm looking at guys who are working with other people, and they're like active, and they're running, and they commitments, and they putting gas in their car and driving halfway across the state of New Jersey, sometimes across the state line, just to tell people, I didn't drink that. And I'm looking at them like, you nuts, man. I got things to do, man. Oh. And they see it. And then as soon as you touch me, I'm like, boom, emotionally sensitive. See? Because I ain't where you at. You should want to see an emotionally sensitive person? I tell you what you do. Next time you taking a shower, let somebody open the window. Show you just how emotionally sensitive you are. Because as soon as that door come open, you go, shut the door! That's what happened to me. I was walking around here in the spiritual pain that I had thought I had overcame. That I thought I had overcome. And that's why I didn't have that experience that I told you about until later. See what I'm saying? And I'm running around, and people are opening up the window on me in the middle of the shower. And instead of saying, excuse me, could you shut the door, please? It's a little chilly. I'm going, shut the door! Shut the door! You nuts! Are you nuts? And people are going, no, I'm not nuts. I'm simply telling you, this is what you have to do next. They wasn't poking and prodding in my personal life. They were trying to say, listen, James, if you plan on having a decent relationship with this young lady, then you need to be this way. Because why would she want somebody with your kind of behavior in her life? Ooh. Shut the door. Shut the door. Barefooting them saying, you know what, James? Because I'm running around here scared to be who I was. Yes, I'm charismatic. Yes, I'm taught the way I do. I share the way I share. And I have to say, James, you did nothing wrong. Be honest. Be who you really are. Don't be a fake. And they gave me some inspiration because I got tired. I used to get scared. I had a group tell me. No, didn't tell me. James, They told my sponsor to come to me and to tell me either I stop talking about God or don't come to that meeting no more. You don't tell Jane nothing like that. And my sponsor knew that he had to tell me because you know why? I was the smart butt in your meeting that says, if you got a problem with my recovery, see my sponsor. So they had a problem with my recovery in their eyes. And I'll never forget what my sponsor said to me at that time. He said, James, you have two choices. He said, you can either give in to what they're asking, or you can do what you know is right for you and allow your feet to be placed to the fire. I allow my feet to be placed to the fire. And the only reason I was able to sustain that in that time that I was in is because just like it said to me on page 68, I did believe in my God. And I knew that my God was big enough to get me sober. He was big enough to get me through this because I wasn't talking about God in a sense to irritating anybody. I was just simply saying, like us politically correct people like to do, for me. Now, I did the best I could. I followed the suit. And when they went around saying, you know, this God stuff, and, you know, and the Catholic priest beat me and the nun slapped me. And I said, you know, maybe she slapped me because you hired it. You know what I mean? And they didn't want to hear that. Just like I did not want to be told that I was cast aside by my family. And when my sponsors then were working with me this way, this stuff is painful. So do the steps apply to a sober person just like they do to a non-sober person? Yes. Like I said last week when I was talking to you, I'm grateful to God that I know today that whenever I hit those emotional walls, that I could back up to 4 and run up to 9 and says, yes, I do believe that I have the willingness to have victory over alcohol. Even sober, I still have that willingness to be willing to do those things. I'm really excited about the fact that, you know, even after this time now, that I'm still excited about newcomers. You know, the guy that comes in, he's difficult. You know, I always like the guy who reminds me of me. There was a meeting I used to go to in another town, and there was a guy who was in the Market Street Mission who was a chronic relapser. An old Polish dude named Pop, we used to call him, I ain't going to mention his name, but he runs around the green, and he'll be in the meetings for a period of time, and he end up going back out drinking. And he would come to the meeting drunk. And for some apparent reason, Pop used to always sit next to me. And I remember one of the warmest moments I ever got from another drunk one night is, you know how some of these meetings when the drunk want to share, you know, some of us are kind of good at it. We go, look, we'll save you a couple of minutes after the meeting, you know, take it easy. And Pop was kind of calm, and he waited for his turn. And finally, at the end of the meeting, he's sitting back there leaning on me, breathing. I'm scared to light a match, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm leaning back on him, you know, because I'm going to be honest with you. There I was sober, but I was having this familiar place with this man. Even in a sober state, I was very comfortable next to him. And there was people looking at this thing that was going on with me and him as if I was strange. And I was feeling that uncomfortability. And this man raised his hand at the end of the meeting. He says, I like Jay, but he's just like me. And there I was in a sober state. And then when I looked at him, I went, yeah, I am. You know, I was like that. Sitting in the meeting, fried. I wasn't cooking. I was done. I ain't never, listen, I don't know about most people. I wasn't doing no sipping. I ain't knocking nobody who could stick the pinky up. When I gripped the bottle, ooh, it was passion. You know what I mean? I think if I grip mama like that more regularly, me and her be all right. But the truth of the matter is that booze, you know, like a lot of people don't. The reason I keep bringing up hints about booze that way is because in the mind of the alcoholic, that is how we truly see booze. But we get in these politically correct situations and we talk about booze badly. So that last couple of pages told me the reason that I'm doing that is because alcohol in my life is nothing but a symbol. It ain't even a symptom anymore. So let's talk about a symptom. Remember when you had a bad cold, you blew your nose? The results that was in the napkin, showed a symptom that you had, which was a runny nose. Now, once the cold is passed and you stumble across an old piece of tissue, that's a symbol. It's not in you, but it reminds you of what was in you. You see where I'm going? That's it. That's how I'm coming to meetings now. And that's the reason why you'll hear me say, I haven't found it necessary, or the thought of a drink never came across my mind, because it's no longer a symptom. It's no more to me than a symbol. And I'm not going to let a symbol dominate my thinking. A symptom might. You think I'm lying? Anybody ever had a bad cold? I'll tell you one symptom that'll get your attention. A sore throat. Yep. When I get a bad cold, the symptom that comes to my mind, I can have runny eyes, nose running, bad cough, but the one symptom that bothers me the most is that sore throat. And guess what else will bother you in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're sober? Sore feelings about not being able to hang out at the bar anymore. Makes you sore. Bill told you that. In a vision for you. There he was. Bill said, I could hear him. I could see Bill just butt so tight he could suck a brick out of the wall. Oh, God, I want to go. I got 50 cents. God, I get a cold beer. And then he probably could hear himself in his mind hearing Dr. Siltworth tell him how frothy emotions seldom suffice. And he said, either I buy a beer or two, or I make some phone calls. Y'all think he did it? Willingly. I can see Bill dropping them nickels like clink, 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 clink. I ain't there. Click. Drop another nickel. That's how it is for a lot of us when we get here. I start coming to AA and I'm walking past the bars. And then I'm listening to a bunch of people telling me you could be free and not drink. And then I leave the meeting, and I drive past my familiar watering hole. Hey, man, that's Frank in there, ain't it? And then we try to tell you, you know, at some point in your life, you'll be able to mix it up a little bit if you have good enough reason. So if Frank's going to have a barbecue at his house, and just because he got a keg there doesn't mean you can't go if you have good enough reason to be there. What if Frank's wife noticed your sobriety? And Frank's in bad space right now. And you get a little invitation. Say, could you come to our barbecue and have a burger? And you go.
But there's booze there.
And miss your opportunity of being an example, good or bad, that AA work. See, I go. I go barbecue's mom. Y'all think I'm loud now. See, one thing I like about barbecues and special events like that is that me and Mama, we like food and fellowship and stuff like that. So it doesn't matter if one of y'all throwing a barbecue or somebody in my past who I thought was reasonably a decent person. Because I realized because of this 12th step in the 7th chapter that I can not necessarily ignore him, but I can take interest in the family and says, if y'all willing to practice certain principles that I now practice as a sober member, you'll be able to live and deal with this sick puppy. And when he gets to a certain point in whatever particular interval that he's at, just slip this over here on his dresser, he'll be all right. And then when he asks you where you got the book, you say, James gave me that book a couple of years ago when you was back there playing pool and drinking with the keg. And then just maybe you might be that person to get that call. And we won't always have to rely only on the active members who put their name down on Night Watch. And running them crazy. They can't even get us to put our name on the list. So can't really get us to be willing enough to do an honest 12th step. Or I'll drop you off a detox. But I ain't even got a problem going up in some of y'all houses. If your wife called me and said, so-and-so I've been here drinking and acting like a fool. I said, yo, Manny, I got some jokers for you. Arnold, yeah, we got a live one. Ding, ding. Who is it? James and us. Open the door. Me, Manny, and them standing there. Well fed, big as a house. And I bring my oldest boy, Marquis, with me if I have to. And I say, ma'am, why don't you put your kids and everybody in the car, go down the street. We'll talk to them. And the book already told me I might have to get violent with you. You jump on me, I'm going to knock your teeth in your mouth. You know, as soon as you hit a drug in my life, because I used to do it. I used to be the baddest thing in the house. As soon as you pop me a shot in the mouth, I didn't mean to do it. And I used to have to go through that. And the only reason I was able to learn how to do that kind of 12-step work because the members that I was involved with down in Dover had to go on the bridges. Because they had guys that was coming around for 10 or 15 years that would go back out drinking, and they would tell the group members, yo, so-and-so, back under the bridge again. And then when they would drive by in their cars and see them out there, they would get out the car, walk over to them. How you doing, man? You all right? We have a guy comes in the Dover meeting once in a while, lit. Last celebration we went to, he was there. He was clothes all, you know, hair matted. Had a bottle in his pocket, and he's sitting in the back seat in the meeting. And after the speaker spoke, we all get in a circle to get ready to pray. And I went to go over and tap him on the shoulder. And one of my favorite old timers kind of jerked my hand. He said, let him sleep. And I went, yeah. And we all backed up, and I looked at him. So when the prayer began, my mind wasn't on that regular little prayer we always do at the end of the meeting. I said a little prayer for him. I don't know if he'll get it or not, but he every now and then he'd run into me and say, Jim, I hate you. I said, Frank, why you going to be like that with me? I hate you loud. All right, Frank. You know? But the point I'm making and where I'm trying to go with, where I'm trying to end this thing up is that we all we got. We all we got. Y'all know that. Every organization, just like the books have told us, ever since man had been crushing grapes, Solomon, known as one of the wisest men on the planet, couldn't figure us out. And people and doctors and organizations and Carl Jung even have to say, whoop, now Carl Jung wasn't no dummy. But when Roller Hazard came in there last time, Carl said, whoa, hey, listen, Slim, you're done. can't help you, man. You know, it kind of reminds me of that old rap song. You know, I can't do nothing for you, man. I did the best that I can, but I can't do nothing for you, man. And there he was saying, but is there any exceptions? Is there any exceptions? And there was some people at that time that was on the spiritual journey. And he says, they may be able to produce something in you that I can't. So again, my mind goes back to synthetic knowledge. The only people I ever seen that had what we had is the people upstairs. So if we can hang in the basement a little longer than we need to, we just may stumble across an idea that just don't belong to them only. That's all it is. No big deal. Because if you as defiant and as resilient as I am, the people upstairs is too busy trying to do a bigger work than just worry about my selfish butt. But because, you know, one sick puppy can't help another sick puppy, down here I might find somebody that understood what I just said. And they may be willing enough to say, hey, man, come on, just sit down, man. You got a cup of coffee? Get a cup of coffee. Sit down. See, you just shut. This is what man telling you, you know? And that's what it took. And it took people say, when I would hear these big book guys talk, I needed the guy sitting next to me saying, this is what he meant. Really? I thought it meant this. He said, nah, this is what it meant. And I remember my eyes going, bump. Because the big book people and the 12-step workers back in the day used to be the kind of people that was far and in between. And some of us who have become big book enthusiasts know for a fact about 7-8 years ago, you sitting in the meeting and you mentioned the first 164 pages, it was like they went, Now every time one of us are trying to do a big book study or we're going to talk about a step, it's become popular, and I'm thankful to God. Because just like the men of old, way before we had a spiritual journey to be on, they had to be persecuted, they had to be talked about, they had to be denied. So don't let yourself get discouraged because somebody had brung you a message that has allowed you to be of maximum benefit to your fellow man and your creator. I'm grateful for that opportunity. I never had value in much or nothing, but to be able to say that I've had the opportunity to watch the lights go off in people's heads, to see men who have hard hearts get a soft heart and care about somebody else. to see a man that didn't worry about nobody else but himself, and he can't wait to help somebody else other than himself. And God bless those men that knew that stood around and saw the miracle happen to me. Could you imagine the guys that didn't give up on a chronic relapsing sick puppy like me? They just kept opening them doors. Drunk or sober, they let me in. I'm grateful for one of our concepts in particular, and the one is the right to participate. If you're willing to work these steps and get you a result from the practicing of these principles, I hope that you act on that and take that right to participate in somebody else's life other than your own. Because some of us are willing to allow you to do that. So I want to, in the last couple of minutes, I want to say that, you know, I'm very grateful for the opportunity that Carrie, the message group, and Mike and his people and all of y'all giving me an opportunity, as unpopular as I can be at times, to come and talk and share my little bit of strength, experience, and hope that was given to me by people like you. In the time that I had in the past couple of weeks to come and share with you, I want to let you know that I was trying to be as gut level honest with you as I possibly could, not to shine and to be cute and to let you think that I'm some kind of brilliant son of a gun that came out of heaven to bestow upon you my super intelligence or anything of the sort. It's not about that. But what I did and what my true intentions was, and I'm going to tell y'all what my motive was, is to get you fired up, to get you pumped up, to get you amped, to let you wake up tomorrow morning with a little bit of fire under your behind telling you, you know what, I can stay sober today and I have the ability to help somebody else in that same day that I'm living in. I like the people that told me don't carry a message if you can't find it in the book. Now, I didn't have enough of time to sit here with my book open and go through paragraph and sentences and et cetera, et cetera. And I know that some of my paraphrasing might have threw some of y'all off. But if you heard me mention a paraphrase and you want to find out where it is later, see me in the parking lot. See, that's my little M.O. I'll see you in the parking lot. You remember, I was one of those bar drinkers like that, too. You know, you get a little loud with me in the bar, I go, yeah, wait till I see him in the parking lot. I ain't get too far from that. God, you know what I mean? God took me from waiting for you in the parking lot to do you harm to waiting for you in the parking lot to see where I could be of service. So Dr. Bob, again, was right. I'm going to stay away from them Freudian things and those complexities that confuse and throw people in all kinds of turmoil. I'm not going to sit here and tell you, I come to AA because booze stopped working. I come to AA because it's the only place I ever came that not only did it not allow booze to continue to be the dominant force in my life, or even some may say the God in my life, because today booze don't control me like that no more. Now, some people might call that heresy in AA. I don't. Because let me tell you something, and I end with this. What do you think bothered the slaves of old worse than anything? Was it because they knew they were in captivity, or because they had to watch others be free? So when you go home tonight, you driving down the street, you think about that. Which one you think really bothered them the most? The fact that they knew that they had their wrists and ankles shackled, or that they saw people walking around free to go where they want to go. That's why the big book thumper ain't like much. Because we go in that bar to get that drunk, go in that place to get them, sit with them, and they said, aren't you worried about the booze on his breath? There's a principle that ain't got nothing to do with AA, y'all, and I'm going to leave it with you. What other people eat, don't make you go to the bathroom. You think about that the next time you scared of a drunk standing in front of your meeting because he's been drinking, you remember that. Because that'll keep you from being the person who God may have put in that person's life to say there's another way. And because you're going to let fear again dominate every aspect of your life. Again, if I have said, done, behaved in a manner at this podium which was unacceptable to you, I honestly ask your forgiveness. I want to say thank you again to the Carry the Message group. I want to let y'all know, stay fired up. Don't let yourself get discouraged. And remember that you have a source that you can tap into anytime that you want if you're willing to tap into it. God bless you. May the good Lord keep you the next time.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. We are people who normally would not mix.
Make a heck of a milkshake, though, wouldn't it?
On behalf of the Carry This Message Group, James, we want to, from the bottom of our hearts, we want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule the past 4 weeks. We have a tradition in this group. Kathy is kind enough to make a card every month for the speaker, and we just want to give this to you. It's signed by all the group members and anyone in attendance tonight. And because it's so apropos, I just want to read the little inscription here. Dear James, the past 4 weeks have been a joy for us as you have shared your personal experience, strength, and hope. Thank you so much for taking the time and caring about carrying the message of AA to whoever is willing to listen, and in parentheses, and to those who aren't, you can talk to them in the parking lot.
Hello!
And on a personal note, I just want to let you know that I love you, and, you know, James and I don't know, I've always liked James despite what anyone else is. But for some reason, we've always connected. And I've got to believe that's because we speak the same language. And today I know it's not the language of the mouth, it's the language of the heart. So thank you.
God bless you, brother. Thank you.